The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Wisdom of Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan, Preserving Jewish Identity in an Age of Assimilation, is dedicated to the memory of the Ilui Nishmas, Rivka Bashraga Fatal, Alea Shalom, Mrs. Rivka Friedman, of blessed memory. In the previous lectures of this series, we trace the early history of Jewry Bechlal as a whole, and the Masorah, the rabbinic chain of tradition, Befrat in particular. Shimon HaTzadik and Antigonos of Socho, the authors of the second and third Mishnahs in Ovos, whom we covered in the last lectures, lived in a time when the Greeks had gained hegemony, domination over Eretz Yisrael. The Jews of this period, it seems, were still fully observant. The challenges of the time were more philosophical and subtle, in all probability due to the Greek influence, and therefore the rabbinic leaders sought to stress the imperative of maintaining the traditional attitude of the primacy of Torah and divine service in Jewish life, and the importance of cultivating an emotional and spiritual bond with the Creator. Hence Shimon HaTzadik's dictum, Al Shloisha Dvorim Ha'olam Oimed, Al HaTorah, Val Avodah, Val Gemilas Chasodim. The world is based upon three things: the study of Torah, divine service, and the practice of loving kindness. And Antigonus Ishocho's dictum, Al Tiyu Kavodim Amasham Shinas Arav, Al Manas Lekalba Pros, Al Tiyu Kavodim Amasham Shinas Arav, Shaloy Al Manas Lekalba Pros, Vimer Shamayim Aleichem. Don't be like servants who serve their master in order to receive a reward, but rather be like servants who serve not for the purpose of receiving reward, and let the fear of heaven be upon you. In the subsequent period, however, Jewry itself went through a dramatic and tragic transformation. In the previous lecture, we touched upon the creation of the nascent sect of the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, the secular movement that was based upon the rejection of the existence of an afterlife and divine providence, two of the major foundations of Jewish belief and philosophy, as well as a denial in the veracity of the oral rabbinic tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the very underpinning of Judaism. The existence of a movement towards secularism in everyday life is clearly evident in the dictum of the successors to Shimon HaTzadik and Antigonus Ishocho. These were Yossi ben Yoezer Ish Tzreda and Yossi ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim. Their sayings are recorded in the fourth and fifth Mishnahs of Ovos, and they read as follows. I'll read the English. Yossi ben Yoezer, a man or leader of Tzreda, and Yossi ben Yochanan, a man or leader of Yerushalayim, received the oral tradition from them, Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous, and Antigonos. Yossi ben Yoezer used to say, quote, "Let your house be a house of meeting for the sages. Let yourself be covered by the dust of their feet and drink their waters with thirst." That was Yossi ben Yoezer's saying. Yossi ben Yochanan and his colleague said, "Let your house be wide open, and let the poor be members of your household. Engage not in excessive conversation with women." They said this with regard to one's own wife. How much more so does this apply with regard to another man's wife? Hence have the sages said, as long as a man engages in too much conversation with women, he causes evil to himself, he goes idle from the study of the words of Torah, and his end will be that he will inherit Gehenim, purgatory. It's evident that they, these scholars had to focus on these issues, not the philosophical issues, but the practical issues, and we'll discuss them in detail what they mean. It's evident that the conditions had changed. The whole thesis of this lecture series is the Torah contains much, much wisdom. Why is it that the sages at this particular juncture in time had to stress these ideas? There's so many ideas. Why? Evidently, these were the ideas it was important that the community hear. So working backwards, if these are the ideas it's important for them to hear at that time, what were the times that generated such needs? Really, that's... And we'll go in greater detail explaining the Mishnah. But if you notice, the stress here is of making one's home a place of meeting of Torah. The idea, the home should be open wide to receive guests. Evidently, these were issues. They weren't issues in previous generations. Evidently, previous generations didn't have a problem studying Torah. It didn't have a problem that there was no necessity of making your home a meeting place, like it was something full of Torah. Evidently, Torah was studied less. And therefore, yours should be the focal point, and you should receive all the Torah scholars. Evidently, if you didn't, it would seem they wouldn't have a place. So it seemed to indicate there was a lessening of Torah studies, and that's why he had to stress this. It would seem also the fact, as he said, let your home be wide open to the poor. It would indicate, A, there were needs of the poor that were not being met, and B, that he had to stress this, and it wouldn't be normally the normal reaction. It seems that people were wary of bringing the poor into their home. Homes were not that hospitable. The fact is that he had to tell them about excessive speech with women, and evidently this was not the problem in previous generations. It's indicative of a change of attitude. And the question is, of course, what is the source of the change of attitude? Why in this generation were they more free? You know, they didn't have compunctions, where in previous generations they did. Now, these were not the issues of the previous generation. They were the issues of that generation. Josephus Flavius, the major Jewish historian of the Second Temple period, traced the beginning of this breakdown in Jewish life with the rise of Yosef ben Tovia, a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik, and the nephew of Chonio, or as he calls Onias, the high priest. According to the story that Josephus tells in the 12th book of his Antiquities, when Tovia's uncle Chonio was delinquent in paying the taxes that the community owed to the king of Egypt, in other words, during that time, Palestine, as well as southern Syria, was part of the Egyptian Empire. And it was controlled by Ptolemy, who was a descendant of one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And as the aristocracy in Egypt in the time were actually Greeks, not Egyptians. They may have intermarried with the local populace, but they were Greek speaking. Their culture was Greek, and they controlled lands beyond Egypt itself. The Kohen Gadol was responsible for collecting taxes. That was his. He was the interface between the Jewish community and the ruling, the dominant community of Egypt. And therefore, it was the Kohen Gadol's responsibility to make sure the taxes were paid. And the government was appeased. And for some reason, and it's really not clear from Josephus what the reason was, he attributes it to the stinginess of Chonio, which is really doesn't bear well. It's just not clear. The problem is, we only have one source of this period, and that's Josephus. It's very difficult dealing with any history with only one source. You don't have the balance. You don't have the full story. And unfortunately, this is a incident which is not described in Talmudic sources. So at least we don't even have that to balance it off. But again, the situation was that he had not paid the taxes, Chonio. The Jews faced severe punishment by the Egyptian army. And his nephew, Yosef ben Tovio, took the initiative. He went down to Egypt, placated his Talmud, and not only that, but eventually received the right to farm the taxes of the entire area north of Egypt. It was that whole area of Gaza, which was really not in Jewish hands at the time. You know, near Jerusalem, that area was in Jewish hands. The whole area of southern Syria fell into the domain of this Yosef ben Tovio. The reason he did this is he outbid all the other tax collectors. They used to farm out. It was competitive bidding. Of course, the people were reluctant to pay such high taxes, and he brought with him a small army. And when the people were reluctant to pay taxes, he just killed them. And he had, you know, people have their methods, I guess. His mother was Shimon HaTzadik's daughter, the sister of Chonio, the high priest, is Yosef ben Tovio. He was a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik, a nephew of Chonio. So he was a miyuchas. You know, he had a prestigious lineage. He became extremely wealthy through this process, and it's evident from the stories that are told about him. He became increasingly influenced by Greek culture, and the state of affairs that this man, and of course to become a tax collector, you can't do it all yourself. You need a whole group. You need a whole infrastructure. So he created a whole corporation of like-minded people. And they became the leadership in the Jewish community. In the words of Josephus, again speaking about the brutal means of tax collection, by this means he gathered great wealth together and made vast gains by this farming of the taxes. And he made use of what estate he had thus gotten in order to support his authority. And he ends this whole story with this good fortune he enjoyed for 22 years. The situation came to a change because Syria started to wage war against northern Syria, began to wage war against Egypt for control of this middle area. As Egypt is in the south, northern Syria, you know, and in between them was this whole buffer zone. And there was a war for many years, this is back and forth, to who to control that area. There's nothing like wars to make tax collecting a little difficult. But it was this family of Tovio, as he passed away, but him, his family, his followers, who actually became Hellenized, that eventually led Jewry upon the path of assimilation, which culminated with the Maccabee Revolt and the subsequent miracle of Hanukkah. So we're dealing with a situation where the leadership of the community, which traditionally had to a great extent been run by the elders. I mean, you have the expression of the will of the people was through these scholars. I mean, and they were all marginalized. And it was really the high priest who had been really shunted aside by his nephew. So this Yosef ben Tovio became the true power in the land of Israel. Only after the Egyptians were defeated was the Sanhedrin, was this body assembly of Jewish scholars, which really represent, they were the most respected people of the Jewish people. The people looked up to them, and they were able to re-exercise their control. And as the historian Rav Isaac Halevi pointed out, when the victorious Antiochus III of Syria first entered Jerusalem, he was greeted by the Sanhedrin, or Senate, as it's called, as Josephus describes them. These were the true spiritual leaders, who now took upon themselves to fill the position, that void of leadership that had been neglected by the Kohen Gadol, the titular head of the state under the Egyptians, and had been usurped by the Tobiites, you know, the family and followers of Yosef ben Tovia. In the words of Antiochus himself, he wrote a letter describing his entrance into Jerusalem. He writes, quote, "Since the Jews, upon our first entrance on their country, demonstrated their friendship towards us, and we came to the city of Jerusalem, they received us in a splendid manner and came to meet us with their Senate." This is how he describes this. So evidently, when they had already taken control, the Senate meaning the Sanhedrin, "and gave abundance of provisions to our soldiers," because they were overjoyed that now the Syrians had taken control and the tax collectors had been shunted aside. "And they gave provisions to the soldiers, to the elephants, and joined with us in ejecting the garrison of the Egyptians that were in the citadel. We have thought fit to reward them and to retrieve the condition of their city, which had been greatly depopulated by such accidents as have befallen its inhabitants, to bring those that had been scattered abroad back to the city." He wanted to repopulate it. It was because of all the problems involved and because of the battles that were fought for years during the period. It was at this time, according to Isaac Halevi, that in addition to the traditional number of 71 members of the Sanhedrin, the highest rabbinical judicial and legislative assembly, there was added a 72nd member called Venosi, the president or prince. Because up until this time, we only know of 71 members of the Sanhedrin, similar to the 70 that were appointed by Moses, you know, Parshas Balosha, and Moses on top of them. So we have a body of 71. The need of a 72nd member was created because of the political conditions. You needed someone who, A, was a great rabbinical authority, was respected, but would, B, would shoulder the problems of the country. So the Nasi was not only just the head of the rabbinical assembly dealing with matters of law or justice, but it was really a matter of he was really the political leader. He was the equivalent of the king. In fact, it's interesting, there's a korban, a sacrifice which is brought if a king sins by through error. If a king, if anyone sins through error, and it's a sin that had it been done with forethought, it would have, the person would have been condemned to the severe penalty of Chorus, like heaven would intercede, the person would have an untimely death, according to Rashi, that is, if his young children would die, God forbid. That's if it was done with premeditation. Of course, it was done with through error of sorts, but still says that one needs an atonement. And that atonement is a korban chatas, a sin offering. There's a sin offering which is a young female lamb or female goat, less than up to a year old, which is brought by everyone under those circumstances. For instance, if one woke up in the morning and forgot it's Shabbos, and then started conducting himself as if it would be Friday, it's Shabbos. He didn't mean anything. Person has made a commitment to keep Shabbos, but as you get older, you get more forgetful. So, in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, or Mirtz Hashem, when the temple will be rebuilt, a person brings a sacrifice. But if a king sins, he brings a male goat, like a little different. And the same sermon, but there's a special Korban, a special sacrifice the king brings. The Gemara says, the Gemara has debates the question about, does the Nasi, the Gemara in Horius in 11b, does the Nasi of the Sanhedrin have the same status as the king? They treat him as a king, as the president of the Sanhedrin. The conclusion is he's not as a king because the exilarch, the one of the whole who is the head of the Jewish community in Babylon, is of a superior position. He's really even of superior position over him. But the Gemara like clears the Shaila. The Gemara really debates the issue. We deal with, in other words, a Nasi of a Sanhedrin is not just a Rosh Hashiva, not just a teacher, but he is a political leader. And it's interesting that the Talmud makes mention about the status of orphans, and says Rabban Gamaliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, he was the Nasi in his time, he's the father of the patron of all orphans. Like that's his worry. I mean, the social needs are on his shoulders. That was the position of the Nasi. Not only, of course, he was the titular head of the Sanhedrin, but it was more than that. He was the political leader dealing with in a very difficult situation. Because normally you have a political leader, of course, who is the king. Here the king is some foreign king. And he is he's the next thing to being a Jewish king. But this was all created, according to Rav Isaac Halevi, during this period, when control of Palestine, of Eretz Yisrael, was wrested from the Egyptians by the Syrians, and now the Senate had a predominant role and was important for them not to make the same mistake as happened before, and they made sure that the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, had the ear of the king. And he was the one who took care of the Jewish people. The one below him, now there were two, was called the Av Beis Din, the position below, the father of the court. So if you in Pirkei Avos, beginning with Yosef ben Yoezer, there are five of these zugos, five of these pairs. Than the statements of these five pairs. This is unique. They had this unique function. So these were the zugos, the pairs. The first Nasi was Yossi ben Yoezer, Ish Sereda. In the midst of the political problems, there were other problems. And the Jewish people were to experience different kinds of crises. Let me quote to you from a Gemara in Temura in Tesvovim and Beis in 15b. We've learned in a Mishnah elsewhere, I'm quoting from the Gemara, when Rabbi Yossi ben Yoezer of Tzereda and Yossi ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim died, the language of them was Botlu Ha'eshkolos. Eshkol, the sin is a grape cluster. The era of the grape clusters came to an end. So the Gemara asked, what does that mean, grape clusters? So really, Eshkolos is really it's a contraction. It means Ish Shahakol Bo. Eshkolos is like Eshkol is Ish Kol, the man who contains everything. He has Torah, he has the fear of God, he has loving kindness, the perfect person. After their death, there was a noted drop in the level of the leadership in all of these areas. And it says, all of the Eshkolos, the grape clusters, who rose from the days of Moses until Yosef ben Yoezer, learned Torah like Moshe, our teacher. There's the level of Torah that whatever Moshe taught was preserved. From that time onward, they did not learn Torah like Moshe, our teacher. So the Gemara challenges that statement. From that statement, it would seem they knew it was all the same. In other words, you'd ask anybody after Moses, he would tell you exactly what Moses, what Moshe Rabbeinu said. So the Gemara challenges, not true. But not review who to report in the name of Shmuel. 3,000 halachas, 3,000 laws were forgotten during the period of mourning for Moshe. After Moses' death, the shock, you know, the Jews were in mourning for 30 days, they discovered they had forgotten certain areas. They didn't remember what was the halacha in this case, in that case, in the other halacha. So those were forgotten. So how could you say that now subsequent generations were the equivalent as in time of Moses? So the Gemara answers, those laws which were forgotten were forgotten. That's true. But those which were learned, they learned like Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, those who were forgotten. But from that time on, it was preserved. And again, the Gemara says, but we've learned after the death of Moses, Moshe, if those who pronounced, there were arguments in the court. If those who pronounced unclean, you know, it was a question about ritual cleanliness, about a certain situation. If those who were unclean were in the majority, the rabbis declared the object unclean. If those who pronounced clean were in the majority, the rabbis declared it clean. So evidently, you see, there were arguments. If they knew everything so clearly, what are they arguing about? So the Gemara answers, their acumen diminished. But the way they learned like Moshe, our teacher. In other words, they didn't have the ability to construct the areas that they didn't know. Accurately. So that's why there was a divergence of opinion. But from the time of the death of Moses, that knowledge which was preserved in its entirety. Rashi points out the areas which they disagreed were those areas that were forgotten, you know. And the Gemara says that the first of the arguments that they had, this lessening happened really during the lifetime of Yossi ben Uezer, towards the end of his life. And the argument was a question of the laws of smicha. Let me explain this. Normally, when a person, a male, brings a sacrifice, very often, and under most circumstances, he puts his hands on the sacrifice. And according to the halacha, not only puts his hand, but he leans on it. And he, if it's a sin offering, he confesses. If it's if it's just a peace offering, he gives thanks, whatever. But he talks to God. But it's a presence you put your hands on and you lean on it. Now, normally, it's the Rabbanan, rabbinically, it's forbidden to use an animal, to ride on an animal, to lean on an animal on Shabbos or on Yom Tov, on the holidays. Because they're afraid, this is all part of the thing, they don't want you to ride an animal on Shabbos. If you're going to ride it normally, the norm was when you're riding it, it was very often you tear off a branch to use it as a goad, you know, as a whip for the animal. It was so common that they outlawed riding entirely, not only riding, but even, you know, leaning on the animal. It's not clear in the Talmud when exactly they created the prohibition, but it would seem to be that it happened during this period of time, the time of Yossi ben Yoezer. This period that we're talking about, during this change between the Egyptians to the Syrians, and they had a problem that they couldn't resolve with a consensus. Normally, you're not allowed to lean on Shabbos and Yom Tov on an animal. Jews brought their animals to the temple on Yom Tov. There's a Korban Chagiga. There's a holiday sacrifice. You're supposed to put your hands on, you're supposed to make smichas somachas to lean. You're supposed to put your hands on the animal. It comes in contradiction with the Yom Tov, where Yom Tov is you're not allowed to put your hands, you're not allowed to lean on any animal. So when they come in contradiction, the mitzvah to put your hands on, which is from the Torah, but the rabbinic prohibition of not to. How do you resolve this? The question was first brought up to Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan, which would be indicative that they didn't have the problem before, because this was newly created, this prohibition, and they were struggling though. But what happens in general when you have this conflict? How do you resolve this? And they couldn't come to a consensus. And that really is a Mishnah this is a Mishnah Chagiga in 16a and b. Yosef ben Yoezer said Shelo Lismach. It comes on Yontif, don't make smicha. Yosef ben Yochanan Lismach, you should make smicha. This argument kept on for generations, all the way to Shammai and Hillel. But it would seem, and the Gemara points out, the fact is that they couldn't resolve this. It's evident that they had forgotten one of the key principles of Jewish law about how to resolve this conflict, and it was indicative that they had already begun to slip. This was the beginning of the slippage. By the time of Rabbi Eliezer, who lived through the destruction of the temple much beyond, and his deathbed, he said, there are thousands and thousands of halachas that I studied under my teachers that I've never given to my disciples. In other words, there was a real, again, the conditions were very bad. They lived through all kinds of disruptions, the destruction of the temple. But it wasn't, there was a lessening in the level of Torah. But it had begun during this period of time. But at the same time, where we have the lessening of the level of Torah, which again, the tradition of the Talmud was, it did not occur at all until this time. As it was like, if you would make a graph, it would be, you know, it would be a flat line, you know, and then it would start to decline. Now, so again, we're dealing with the year prior, in the year one, between 190 and before the Common Era. Interesting, side by side with this idea, again, we have the idea of Yossi ben Yoezer, this whole idea of Zugas, of the pairs, which is indicative of the change of political situation. We have the idea of the lessening of the level of Torah knowledge. And we have another factor here as well. It has been taught, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov said, I have heard that the Beis Din may, when necessary, impose flagellation, that's the flog, and pronounce capital sentences even where not warranted by the Torah, yet not with the intention of disregarding the Torah, but on the contrary, in order to safeguard it. In other words, they are allowed to employ emergency measures, similar to martial law, you know, that the government can employ. It once happened, the Gemara continues, that a man rode a horse on the Sabbath in the Greek period. Notice the riding of the horse, you know. With the smicha. And he was brought before the court and stoned. Not because he was liable thereto, because it was practically required. It was a practicality that was required by the time. Because normally you wouldn't stone a person for violating a rabbinic law, but they had to make a strong statement here. But it's interesting, when you had someone who wanted to violate it, he could have lit a match, you know what I mean? He could lit tinder, he could have wrote. What do you have to ride a horse for? This man said he's keeping Shabbos. So he doesn't like the rabbis making new laws here. Like, who are they to control my life? And that's why they killed him. But it's indicative of what was happening. And it has to do with this idea of this leaning, which was really one of the fences. It was a siyog. But during Greek times, the people were not, at least not all the people, were so amenable. And it was to the extent that they had to make they had to make an example of this person, to put him to death, to prevent all the others. So really, this, of course, is the period right before the mass assimilation led up to the Hanukkah story. But we can have a feeling of really what's happening already. Eventually, the forces of assimilation gained the upper hand as the secularized Jews sought help from the king of Syria, Antiochus IV, this is Epiphanus, to forcibly assimilate the Jews. All of this we covered in great detail in previous lectures devoted to the Hanukkah story. In the midst of all of these events, Rav Yossi ben Yoezer was martyred by the Greeks. The Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Toldos relates the following story. And Yochum Ish Tzororos, the man of Tzororos, it's not clear that the derivation, it's really a name of a village, was the son of the sister of Yossi ben Yoezer. This is the, you know, Yossi ben Yoezer, this is Ish Tzoreda. He was, again, the horse comes out. He was riding a horse on Shabbos in front of Yossi ben Yoezer. This is as Reb Yossi was being transported to be hanged or crucified by the Greeks. This is Solov, and it could be. In other words, they were taking him out. This is in the Greek period. This is the time when the Hanukkah story. This is before the Maccabees were successful. And they took him out, you know, because he was the leader. And they took him out to be killed. This Yochum Ish Tzororos was already an assimilated Jew. He was riding a horse on Shabbos. And he was mocking his uncle. Now there's this, again, this Yochum Ish Tzororos was the nephew, was the son of the sister. Told him, look at the horse upon which my master is transporting me. Now he's referring either to his Greek lord or his Greek god. And look at the horse upon which your master is transporting you. In other words, he was taken out to be killed, so he's put on a horse. It's interesting how horses play such a role here. Rav Yossi replied to him, if those that anger Hashem are afforded such treatment, in other words, look at the good treatment that you're afforded, then most certainly those that fulfill His wills are destined to be afforded wonderful treatment. Maybe not in this world, the next world. Basically, you're being paid for the little good that you do. Yochum asked them, is there anyone fulfill God's will more than you? Like, why should you suffer? He replied, if those who do His will are judged so harshly, you know, the standards are so high, most certainly those who violate His will are destined to be treated harshly. That statement went into him, to Yochum, like snake's poison. And Yochum regretted his former life and proceeded to inflict upon himself all four types of death sentences for all of the numerous sins that he'd committed. He decided to commit suicide, not just commit suicide, to die. He self-inflicted all these four types of deaths: stoning, burning, murder by the sword, and hanging. What did he do? And it really goes on to describe a Rube Goldberg contraption. How he was able to do all of this. He brought a beam and drove it into the ground. He tied a cord to it. So that was a cord. This is on top of the beam. He was going to hang himself on that cord. And arranged a pile of wood adjacent to it. And surrounded it with a wall of stones. So if you could picture it, we have this post. On top of it is a noose. Below is wood, which is going to be kindled soon. And near there is a pile of stones, like a very tall pile of stones, which just surrounds everything. He made a bonfire in front of it, and is with the wood. In the middle of it, he put a sword. And in the middle of the wood is burning, there was a sword that was sticking up. He then lit a fire under the wood, which is by the stones. He first hung himself from the beam. As then he got up, it was started just to smolder the fire. It didn't start getting up. I guess he got a ladder of sorts, whatever it is, climbed on top of the beam, and put the noose around him. You know, and then, you know, let go. And he began to suffocate. The fire came and severed the cord. Eventually it went up, burned the cord, and his body, says, fell into the wood. The sword then plunged through him, through his body. So here he had hanging, he had burning, he had saif, he had the sword. And as he fell, the wall of stones collapsed over him as his body was being burned, and he had skila stoning. Yossi ben Yoezer was dozing off, even though he was crucified, it would seem. And he was still alive, but he was losing his consciousness. As he saw a vision of the bier of Joachim, in other words, of his apparition, flying through the air, he saw him entering heaven. And he said, he even came into Gan Eden a short while before me. He came to paradise. In other words, this Joachim, who did this, had total remorse for his life and committed suicide. And there's a whole question, if this is a medrash, and there's a whole question of to what extent can you derive practical Jewish law from a medrash. There's a whole discussion, can one commit suicide as an atonement based on this incident? But in any case, it really gives us a view into the period. Here we have, again, just like it's interesting, like Yosef ben Tovia, who was the nephew of the high priest, a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik, who really went off. Here we have Yossi ben Yoezer, again, who is the most prominent member, the most pious member of the Jewish people, and has a nephew like this. And again, the riding of the horse has this connotation because it was the thing that was instituted by the Rabbonim at that time. In the light of all of this, I'd like to return once more to Ovis. And again, although the saying is indicative of the time, the importance of, that's what he said, in periods like this, you had to make sure the Torah was continued on. And your house should be the place of study. Because not necessarily the houses of study will be full of people. And this make your home a house of study. Because you should have a close relationship to scholars. Evidently, it's indicative that at that time you couldn't take it for granted. I want to explain how the Medrash, the Ovis Rabbi Nosson, interprets this Mishnah. And again, the Mishnah is, let your house be a house of meeting for the sages, let yourself be covered by the dust of their feet, and drink their words with thirst. The Medrash says, what does it mean, let your house be a house of meeting for the sages? It teaches us that one's house should be set aside to be a place where scholars, their disciples, and their disciples' students will frequent to such an extent that, for instance, when one scholar meets another and says, you know, I'll be waiting for you at a certain place, the place of choice will be your home. You know, they know this is the place to be. Another explanation, that's one explanation. Another explanation is, let your house be a house of meeting for the sages, is that when a disciple of a scholar, a Talmud Chacham, comes to you and says, teach me, because you yourself are a scholar. And someone comes to you and says, you know, who's knowledgeable but wants to take from your knowledge. Don't hoard your knowledge, share it. If you have the knowledge, you should teach him. And if not, send immediately on his way to study under someone who does know. He shouldn't sit before you, and when you teach him, there should be a relationship of a Rebbe and a disciple. He shouldn't sit before you while on a bed or chair or couch. Rather, he should sit on the ground before you. He should accept everything that issues from your mouth with awe, fear, trembling, and sweat.
Just as our forefathers received the Torah at Sinai with awe, fear, trembling, and sweat. So, it either means, according to this, A, says that let your house be open for the scholars, or B, if you're a scholar yourself, open your house. It says open your house and let those who could drink of your waters come and drink. What is the meaning of the phrase, let yourself be covered by the dust of their feet? And again, the Medrash says it teaches us that one shouldn't say that I don't need to study under a scholar. Rather, you should go and study under him. Unless you find yourself a Rebbe. Don't sit. And again, you should, by the dust of the feet, meaning that one should submit himself. Don't to this Rebbe. Don't sit next to him on a bed or a chair or a couch. That you should sit on the ground before him. Accept everything that issues from his mouth with awe, fear, trembling, and sweat. Just as our forefathers received the Torah at Sinai with awe, fear, trembling, and sweat. So this is the version of Avos Rebbe Nosson, that we have. There's another version of Avos Rebbe Nosson. And this was lying in the Bodleian Library at Oxford University before it was discovered by Solomon Schechter when he was still on the faculty of Jews College in London. This happened before he joined the faculty of Cambridge University, became famous for his work on the Cairo Geniza. So he had just come to England. And he discovered this, and he published it. This Medrash contains other important traditions not included in the version which is printed in the standard Talmud text at the end of Maseches Avodah Zorah, the Tractate of Avodah Zorah. And I'd like to share at least some of those insights with you just briefly. Some of them, of course, are what we've covered in the original version. It says, when you have scholars and their students walking into a home of a person, the house is blessed, comes blessed in their merit. And it goes on to cite sources. That's another view of that. As your house becomes a better house. Another idea here is Hoylech el Chachomim Yechkom. A person who goes to scholars becomes wise. And they gave an analogy, Moshe Lechosh Nichols to Chanusa Shoboisim. It's an analogy, someone walks into a store that sells spices. Even though you're not sold any, you don't take anything with you, you leave the store and the fragrance, clings to you. So too, the idea of clinging to scholars, you become greater in the process. So again, this is interesting. About the idea of having misavik ba'far raglehem, that you should be by the dust, to be covered by the dust of their feet. The second version says, "Imamalta b'Torah b'olam hazeh, if you've toiled in Torah in this world, soif liyasif sosecha misnashko islosolavoi." The end is, your lips will kiss of Torah says in the world to come. Studying Torah in this world is an investment. It continues on. And then again, another. There's much material, but I just want to say very interesting thoughts here about v'shoyse. About tzome, it says es divrehem, and drink with thirst with their words. He says shekol zman shedivreter nichnosen umaitziin chadrei leit penuyim. Says when the words of Torah come in, you find that the walls of the heart are empty. It has a place to enter. He nichnosen v'sherem v'seichot. It comes in and dwells there. And the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, does not dwell there. However, if a person, if your heart is already filled, Torah just doesn't enter. It's like water. Sometimes if you're not in the mood, you can eat. But drinking water, you really have to be thirsty. This is the current recommendation of a medical establishment is to drink eight glasses a day. I don't know anyone who drinks eight glasses a day. And the reason is it's hard to drink water, says, if you're not thirsty. You know, Sprite, Pepsi, you know, but water, you know, it's difficult. You should drink, so you're only going to drink water when you're thirsty. Heavy shaisis is katsome, says Estev Reim. Torah is likened to water. Hoi kotsome says everyone says anyone who's thirsty come to water. It has to be like water. And if you do it with that enthusiasm, it invigorates you, it fills you. Otherwise, it just, how much can you drink? It has no effect. The next Mishnah, of course, is devoted to the teaching of Yossi ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim. You know, and he said, let your house be wide open, let the poor be members of your household. There are those who explain this, again, in terms of the Greek period, where it became more the norm to buy slaves. And he says, don't buy slaves, employ the Jewish poor. Evidently, it was a lot easier to deal with non-Jewish slaves than to deal with Jews as employees. Anyone who's in business knows this. It's like akin to the cute story of, you know, of Ben Gurion, who was speaking to Churchill, and he says, "You may be the prime minister of 50 million Englishmen, but I am the prime minister of 2 million prime ministers." But nonetheless, he says, employ the Jewish poor. So that's this one explanation. The Medrash, and again, you know, like all of Torah, it's understood on various levels. And all the levels are true. You know, it could be understood on a level which is important for the time. It could be, there's a timeless message here. But the idea of let your house be wide open, the Medrash Obos Rabbi Nosson says, your house should be like that of Job's, Eov. Eov, Job, had four entrances to his house. They're all wide open. And the reason is that he wanted to make it easier for the poor to come to the house. You know, if it would be just one entrance, he has to go all around. He wanted to make it easier. It's hard enough being poor. It's hard to take someone's charity. At least he wanted to ease the pain and make it easier for them to come in. He says, what is the meaning, let the poor be members of your household? So he says, the Obus of Nosson says, the poor should be so comfortable. Really, it's not speaking, we quoted the explanation, they should be your employees. The Obus of Nosson learns differently, though. It says, no, that they should be, the poor should come, and they don't have themselves. You share what you have, you give tzedakah. But they should be members of your household. They should feel so comfortable they can just come into your house. You know, that the food and drink in your home should be their topic of conversation. You know, people like two guys talking, yo, well, how was the chont? You know, the kugel was great. You know, they should feel it's their home. And again, this is part of the chesed. You know, it's a beautiful story. You know, like, thank God we're very blessed in America. And I say this is, we have, even generally, maybe there are exceptions, but generally, especially in the Jewish community, it's hard to find someone who doesn't have hot and cold running water. Our ancestors, our grandparents in Europe, didn't have that. It's hard to find someone who doesn't have indoor plumbing. You know, there's the toilets and there's no outhouse. There may be an Appalachian, but in our communities, we don't find this. It's hard to find people who don't have central heat. And it's becoming less and less common to find people who don't have central air conditioning. This is, in terms of the creature comfort, this is like unknown. You know, imagine you go out in the street, okay, it's raining, but at least the roads are paved, the sidewalk. If you'd walk in the streets of the shtetlach that are Zaydas, Babas, Kings, and there's blood. There was mud. Now we live in tremendous. We all have generally, again, there are exceptions, but generally, we all have cars. Cars with the suspension that we have, if it's in right working order, is much more comfortable than any of the carriages that the wealthy had in Europe 100 years, 200 years ago. We live in tremendous wealth. So it's really hard to, when you see a person who's really without, it's hard to think in those terms. There's a beautiful story with Yecheskel Landau, who was the chief rabbi of Prague in the last half of the 18th century. And it was a very bitter winter, and he came late at night to the home of a wealthy man. He knocked on the door. The man had already changed into his night clothing, so it was, you know, the long robes, you know, the long nightgown, you know, with a nightcap. And he came in, you know, with a candle. You can see this, you know, opening the door. And he says, you know, Rabbi, you know, it's very cold, you know, and his teeth are chattering. Why don't you come in? No, just it'll take me a second. And he went on, and the door was open, and this person only had his night clothes on. He says, you know, it's the poor are really suffering now. They don't have any firewood. You know, it's very cold now, you know. I mean, if you could spare any firewood that we can go and distribute in the homes of the poor. So sure, so Rabbi, see that whole woodshed is all like, I don't need it. Take it all. Get your people to come here and empty it all out. He thanked him profusely, the rabbi, and the man asked the rabbi, But what did I have to stand here like this for? You could have come into the house and told me that. He says, you're right, but you wouldn't have felt the cold that they're suffering unless you would have stood right now with that open door. Now you're willing to give that wood. You wouldn't be willing to give otherwise. You didn't feel their pain. Evidently, it would seem the Jews... there became a split, became the haves and the have-nots in that community. We're speaking about Yosef ben Tovia, the very wealthy Jews. In the process, when the it's like the old song, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And there was a class distinction, and there was a necessity to intervene on the part for the poor. He was addressing people of wealth. People who no longer felt that pain, and he had to tell them. So that's the first thing. The second one is the word aniyim, a totally different explanation. Aniyim does not mean impoverished, but it means humble. Teach your family humility and patience, because when a person is household or humble and patient, and a poor man comes to the door and asks, is your father here? They will answer in the affirmative and tell him, come right in. He'll find the table already set for him. He will eat and drink and bless the name of heaven. He will experience tremendous satisfaction. But if a person is not humble and patient, however, and his household is strict and impatient, when a man comes to his door and asks, is your father home? The reply will be no. Or it's like the thing the kid answers, they'll come and say, just wait a minute. Tell him I'm not here, you know. Nobody... The kid will answer no, and the man will be sternly asked to leave and be ejected with much ill will. Another explanation is when a man is humble and patient, and so to his family, when he goes abroad, he will travel with peace of mind and thank God that his wife and children have not started some argument with someone else in the neighborhood. If they're not humble and patient, then we'll travel with much anxiety and we'll constantly pray that no fighting should break out in his absence. Another explanation here. Let me go on to the next part of the mission. I'll open up the questions. Say, engage not excessive conversation with women. And this is the note is excessive conversation. Conversation is part and parcel of the dynamics of a husband and a wife. But the question is, life is very short, and time is precious. And it's very pleasurable to speak to your wife. But it's done in excess, that's all that time that, you know, there comes an accounting time at the end of the of our life. And most certainly, of course, applies to with somebody else, the prohibition with somebody else's wife. But there's another aspect to this, and not just about wasting time or frivolity. And this again is from Avraham Reynosen. When a person comes home from a Beis Medrash, from a study hall, and wasn't shown the proper respect or had a disagreement with a colleague, he shouldn't go and tell his wife the full story. I.e., this is what he told me, this is what I said in reply. For only disgrace himself, his wife, and his colleague. In other words, he comes, basically tells his wife that no one respects me. So how is his wife going to respect him? Now, he wants to unburden himself. But it's important for his wife that he be looked, you know, he be a pillar, you know, of stability. You know, if he's not treated with respect and his wife senses this, she loses her whole sense of security. First, she'll act with derision with him. That's one of the scenarios. And then his wife will go and tell somebody else. And then it'll get back to the colleague who originally told him. And the colleague hears this, you know, he goes and says, I tell this to him in private, and I should tell his wife, and the whole world knows about this, and it really expands further. But another aspect of this, of course, is the story of Korach. Korach was one of the leaders of the Jewish people. He was overlooked for a position of leadership. And his wife took particular offense to this. She felt that her husband was worthy of this. And she was the one who egged him on to create this whole revolution to try to displace Moshe. Of course, it ended with Korach's death and his wife's death and the death of many, many people. So it's important, you know, to know what to say and what not to say. Because you have to realize that to the person, it's a very important the wife views the husband, you know, being a person of the highest stature. And when she feels either that he's not of the highest stature, or she feels that stature, that position is being threatened, she could cause him and her emotion and all the great good motives to do things which otherwise, you know, would be a cause of a tremendous regret. So again, there's the idea of course you have to share with your wife, but you have to be careful knowing how her reaction will be. This is what yes and what no. And if you feel the need to unburden yourself, you know, there's the idea, of course, of having male friends. It isn't just, your wife is a very close, Reyim Ahuvim, but there is the function of having friends of your own gender, which you can share things which are not really the things to be shared to a person who feels threatened with that knowledge. Are there any questions?
The Antiochus, who was warmly greeted by the Sanhedrin, would appear to have had an interest in being positive towards...
He was the grandfather of the Antiochus, who was the villain of the Hanukkah story. Right. He was Antiochus the Third, called Antiochus the Great. And the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story is Antiochus the Fourth. So it was a different Antiochus. Same family, but yeah.
Do we have a lot of other examples in the Mishnah of things that we learned from these early Tanaim? Or it seems like we really only start hearing from the time of Hillel and Shammah.
Right. The question is about, do we have much from this early period? And the answer is that no, because up until this time, the Torah itself was learned without, it was the same Torah. There was no necessity to attach a name to anybody. This Yossi ben Yoezer, we have incidents about him. The Mishnah in Chagiga describes him as Chosid Shebekahuna. He He was a Kohen. He's the most pious of all the Kohanim. And discuss him just as a by, in passing. But there's very little, except we have the argument of the smicha, of the putting on the hands, which really was unique because he had an opinion. There were other things that he gave testimony during his life about certain things. It was a question about their status, and he gave testimony about them. But we very little of those early generations. We really begin to hear in earnest in the time of Hillel and Shammai and on. Okay. Good night, and Hamid Hashem. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
You're asking the question about why is it that a tzaddik of that, that stature should suffer, such a fate. There's a klal, the Gemara says, in several places in Shas and Bava Kamma and Dav Nun and Tainus and Dav Ches, that the tzaddikim are held to a very, very high standard. And not only they're responsible for what they may or may not have, but if they had the power to oppose, to protest the goings-on of the generation, they did not, they're also held responsible. So a leader has a tremendous amount of achrayas, responsibility, and they're held to a very high standard. So he was like, this is akin to the martyrs in Asur who became malchus.
That was some way to infer that he didn't do everything possible he could have to turn things around.
Perhaps, it's hard really to know without a medrash saying or this saying, why did this happen? It's really, it's pure conjecture. But we just know, in general, A, that they're held to a high standard, and B, that they have a responsibility for the generation. And this was a generation that really drastically moved away from Yiddishkeit. So, it's like, when Vietnam fell, so who's responsible?
The Elo Elo. If they're opposite polarities, it still seems problematic.
Well, that's a different question entirely, right? Yeah. You're just asking, just in general, the question of Elo Velo Divul Kim Chaim. How could Beis Sham and Beis Hill both be right? It's like from Fiddler on the Roof. You're right, and you're right, and you're also right. It seems that there's a medrash that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up, at least again, it's midrashic, but that he was shown 49 arguments of Tumah, 49 arguments of Tyra, of cleanliness, uncleanliness, and they asked, Moshe Rabbeinu asked, so what's the halachas? Whatever Bezin decides. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was shown all the different variations of how the human mind could view this. Like it's akin to quantum mechanics. There's a certain certain uncertainty which is brought, which is in the process. Whatever Besden decides, like whatever the observer sees, whatever Besden decides, that becomes Hashem is maskim to be. That's the halacha. So it's really according to that medrash, in that view, it's really Hashem agrees. Since Hashem created us with the possibility of making these different ways of looking at this, even though that may not be the correct method, but we as humans, even when we apply the correct methodology, because if that's not applied, then it's not even halachic, but you apply the method, but still I see difference. I know this makes more you wear glasses. I've gone through an eye examination where he says, now how does it look better, this way or this way? Can I see that again? This way. It's hard to make the subtleties. This is part of the human condition. Hashem created us with this. And therefore, in a certain sense, there's a certain plasticity of halacha within a certain narrow framework, just like it's going to be akin to quantum mechanics. It's good. The electrons only can be here or there. It's not going to be all over the place. But within a certain framework, there's a certain uncertainty. And halach was really created in that. And what the observer, see, that becomes, Hashem is maskim to be the halach.
Although that still always has to do with the the wall falling and the thing going and so on, the glass tiles and so on. That would be pretty, that seems to be pretty strong saying, and that's what I meant.
So the idea of Rebbe Eliezer, it seems that's not, it came, it was a covet of Rebbe. They basically don't dismiss him. Because listen to what he says. Ultimately, it's in your hands to figure, but it was a covet, it really was kam l'chvav, though. Don't dismiss what he has, reconsider it. But it was the Shemayim was not telling the Bezdin how to rule.
That he picked Yoyev before Ephraim. So I didn't say Avraham Avinu Zion. In other words, why should the paradigm, the prototype, I should say, the prototype be Yoyev and not Avraham?
Well, it says Avraham was even better than Eiv. Avraham went after them. You know, he was more passive, and he didn't demand the level of Avram for us. It's okay, you can't just be an Eev. You don't have to be an Avram.
Guys, thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked about that is because I was thinking it's really like from Ezra and Nehemiah until Lo and Shammai, we really don't have
much. These incidents. Right. Thank God it's as an incident. Right, because it's really the halach was preserved, so we don't. There wasn't much that they added. They were basically preservers of tradition. Later on, they really changed their focus as really to reconstruct. You know, there's certain things like archaeologists, the ones like who discover the thing, you know, basically it's to preserve what you have. And others, if you have half a document or half of this, you have to reconstruct, like, what was the other? That's another, you know.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.